Hey, everyone, and welcome to Cheers to Leaving. I'm your host, Rachel, and I am really excited for our guest today. We have a musician with us, which is super exciting. We've never had a musician before, so I'm excited to ask all the questions. And a plus is her music is awesome. So you guys are going to be really excited for this. So to introduce her, I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about her. She is a Canadian queer alt-pop artist named Adeline, who has over 80 songs licensed in film and TV. Her music fuses powerfully evocative music with an emotionally unbound lyrical honesty. She just released a purity culture-inspired single, True Love Waits, which is the third single from an upcoming EP, Hymnal, out March 22nd. And that follows her journey of reconciling queerness and the harmful religious narratives that she experienced growing up as the daughter of an evangelical minister. The song is inspired by her teen years within the purity culture movement and is also inspired by the experiences of people within the Bad Believer community, which is a nonprofit organization Adeline founded in 2020 that helps LGBTQ plus people heal from religious trauma. So, welcome, Adeline. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And thanks for the kind words. Very nice.
You're welcome. There was so much when I first learned about you that I was excited about. And I immediately went over to Bad Believer community as well. And read up on that. And I was like, that is so awesome, because community is such a huge thing that we lose when we leave our 100%. Religious environments. And especially in the queer community as well, that's kind of like a double whammy as well when leaving the church, and kind of the rejection there as well. I feel like it's doubled as opposed from maybe like straight people. Agreed. So I thought that was awesome, and I'm definitely going to ask you about that. But first, just to sort of like get to know you a little bit more, I was wondering if you could give our listeners like a brief synopsis of growing up as a daughter of a minister and like what your experience with religion was like.
Yeah, of course. I agree with everything you said. And within Bad Believer, you know, we have a lot of conversations and there's a lot of heartbreak around the double whammy that you just described. Yeah. So that was really well said. I grew up in Canada in a Pentecostal system. So, which was, you know, at the time was right when like Vineyard was really starting to explode and Hillsong and everything else. So it was really charismatic, extremely emotive, connective, intimate. I definitely felt that Jesus was my best friend. I found a lot of comfort in that growing up. And I, from a young age, was performing and singing on stage. So there was also that aspect of being really comfortable connecting with people, which is something I feel like I enjoy the benefit of now. That's something that I do feel grateful for, just that experience. But there was also like this aspect of constantly affirming that I was very special, which I think in my adult years, I've really had to untangle in an uncomfortable way, just to kind of embrace my normalcy, to take away that sort of constant anointing language that I sort of grew up with. Because as the pastor's daughter, obviously that's also a position that is given like weight, in ways that are egoically really nice and in ways that were obviously stressful. So we had mid to large size churches, I'd say. So it wasn't like small church communities. So there was this aspect of feeling looked at. We can get into purity culture too, as far as what that meant for my body and being on stage and things like that. But there was a lot of pressure, obviously, to represent my father, to represent my family. I didn't have much of a rebellious spirit. So I had no problem sort of staying in line, I'd say, for most of my teen years. And that really had a lot to do with the fact that I really deeply did feel connected to the religion and to evangelicalism and the mission of bringing my friends to church. And like that really resonated with me for a long time. In fact, it wasn't until in my late 20s that I left, really. So that was a big sense of purpose. So I didn't have the classic rebellious minister's daughter story that I feel like is expected from the pressure. But I did have a period of time later on where I explored, but more from a sense of like curiosity as opposed to pointed rebellion. And that's probably because I had a relatively solid family. Like I didn't see a lot of hypocrisy. My father was, I'd say, a good pastor. And so I didn't really have a lot of dissonance growing up, and it kind of all made sense to me in a really beautiful, comforting way that has been very hard to let go of. Yeah.
Yeah. The comfort is so hard to let go of. Ugh. And that is, I mean, I think that's not a terrible experience though. If you didn't see a ton of hypocrisy and if you, I mean, I think there definitely is a more right way to do religion and to do, to be an example, I guess, in that way. Like it doesn't make it, I think it's a hard thing to grapple with now that I've personally left, but it's I think that there are good ways to do it. And I think that's what's hard to, like, if it's not harming anyone, if it's not, if it's, you're finding comfort in it, et cetera, it's, I mean, I don't have any like personal issues with that. So I think that's not a, you know, a terrible experience. And it makes sense why you wouldn't necessarily rebel from that, because you were like, okay, this is making sense to me. This is also all you ever knew, but you were like, this makes sense. People are following through with their words. People are, you know, this is giving me something, I guess. And then plus you had music, which you obviously are very, you know, still very much connected to and inclined to. So yeah, that makes sense.
It's interesting. I don't feel a lot of bitterness necessarily towards the people I had growing up. It's more like blinders being taken off and you just can't unsee after you've sort of seen. And then it's more of just sad because, you know, a lot of good people get mixed in with people that are not. So there's also like that aspect of it that's very sad, but also the mission felt very real. So I know that from the outside, looking in from people who aren't from the system, it looked like everyone was just trying to save everyone from like a total egoic place, which I think did happen, obviously. But there was like genuinely this feeling that if you didn't save people, they were going to go to hell. So yeah, like that mission was really important. And I think it can come from a good place if people are bought in on that level where they really do believe that to be true, because then they're trying genuinely to save you. So it's a confusing landscape because there's so much good and bad all mixed together. It makes it really hard to decipher it.
Yeah, for sure. And I definitely can relate to the blinders coming off. That's like actually a perfect way to describe it. Cause like, it's like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's almost like it's not even a choice at that point, which is an interesting way to describe deconstruction. Cause it very much feels like a choice, but it's like not. Once your brain gets a hold of something and starts to explore that and be curious about it, it's like impossible to go back to anything like pre that, unless you just want to be in straight up denial. But just what you were saying too, it becomes there's like a sad part of the deconstruction journey as well, letting go.
No, and I feel like what's frustrating about the deconstruction side of things is everyone looks at it, especially within conservative circles, as being like an angry process. It's not necessarily angry. Yes, it can be. And for a lot of people, it should be. Yes. A lot of people were abused and deeply hurt. But there's also an experience of deconstruction where you're like, it's heartbreaking because you're letting go of something that meant a lot to you. So it's not all like wanting to stick it to everybody. That's not everybody's experience. And I think that that actually adds a layer that should help people to feel like empathy towards what it might feel like for something that you love to all of a sudden not resonate, especially if you're queer. There should be a level of understanding of the sadness, but instead I think a lot of people assume that everyone is like angry and that gets their back up. So they don't actually ever take a moment to try to understand what it's like to lose something that's important to you.
Yeah, Yeah, for sure. That is definitely a lesser part of deconstruction that I think is talked about, because it does come off as such like a harsh, angry thing. And I think the first stage might be anger for some people initially.
Yeah.
But it really just sort of snowballs from there. It's like going through the stages of grief, honestly. So okay. I don't feel like it's that hard to understand, but I think at least to like the community of believers, it just looks like you are purposefully rejecting and being like, I don't, you know, you guys suck and everything you believe yeah. in sucks. And, you know, it looks like that, but in reality, like, one, I don't think you have a choice. Cause like we said, once blinders are off, they're off. And two, like the inability to empathize or even try to understand what might be going on. There's this, like, it's almost like a grabbing thing where it's like, no. If we let you go, we failed. If we,
totally.
You know, if you leave, like we failed, and then there's like guilt and shame on them. And then they're just like, well, you know, you chose wrong and that's your problem. And then there's the threat of hell and all of that. But yeah, it's such a complex process and it looks different for everyone. And I see the same reactions from believers every single time. And I'm like,
yes.
Maybe if you just want to like chill out and try to understand where we're coming from. But then I think if they did that, there would be a lot more people deconstructing as well. So,
yeah, well, and it's wild because even the terms, my dad and I have long discussions about this. He has like a PhD in theology and is very, very rooted in that. But he often will talk about deconstruction. And it's funny because it actually is, no one's really defined what it is. So there's all these books yeah. written about how dangerous deconstruction is. But I'm like, mm-hmm. yeah, but what is the definition of it? No one's really actually saying, because the truth is deconstruction can actually be a really good thing for someone's faith. It could actually deepen faith because you're yeah. actually rebuilding from a place of honesty and examination.
And you're choosing it.
That exactly.
You're like making a conscious choice. It's not just being handed to you. So yeah.
Right. So it's not all, so that's the problem is that people throw around a word that no one is defining. So then mm-hmm. it takes on this sort of, it becomes like demonized. And when really it's like, we're just talking about asking questions of a system, which is something that's really right. important to do.
Yes. And a healthy did that. System. Right.
Yeah.
Jesus did
yeah.
that. It's always, and the more I deconstruct, the more I like look at Jesus and his story. And then I look at the church and I'm like, y'all aren't even doing anything that Jesus was about. Like, I feel like if like religion in general, and I know that there are some, you know, denominations and people who are like this, but if it was more like Jesus, I might be yes. more inclined to stay, you know, in that sort of environment. Cause I was like, he asked questions, he challenged the norms, and he, you know, did a lot of great things. Kind of like, I mean, a lot of his philosophy was, you know, along the lines of like what Buddha taught as well. Like, it's all just very like peaceful, loving, living together mm-hmm. and harmony type stuff. And it's like, but I really do feel like religion always gets to a point where it becomes about power and control. And I think it's because we're human beings and that's sort of our end goal always. Like, there's always some sort of corruption and it becomes like, well, you can't ask questions because then I can't control you. And you can't ask questions because then I can't tell you what this says and what it doesn't. And so I don't think that that always has to happen, but I do think it inevitably does.
I agree with
you.
So
that's why deconstruction is a...
No, it's true. And I mean, I think that in the ultimate irony of it is often the inability for those of us who look at spiritual leaders and ask questions, the inability for them to actually articulate what they believe without this sort of spin, this like Christian spin that happens all the time, is what often causes the deconstruction journey. Like,
right.
if you can't go and ask questions and have someone answer them in a way that resonates with you, when you're in college or whatever, that tends to be when people start to ask those questions. Then mm-hmm. that's a problem. So you can't be upset that people are asking questions to which you won't answer and then be frustrated that they are on a journey of trying to understand who they are. I mean, that's the most natural thing ever that could happen.
Right. Yeah. It's like a very coming of age thing
yes.
to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also I thought it was funny that you used the word rebellious spirit, which I always just think is funny to look back on now, because it was actually just like normal adolescent things right. that we were doing. We just always were like, oh, she has the spirit of rebellion, Jezebel. And you're just like, literally, that is just like, it's like a rite of passage. You're supposed to figure out who you are. And if you can't, then you do it later on in your adult years. And it's even harder then, which is definitely something I did. But I just think it's so funny. It's called rebellion when it's like a very normal pushing the boundaries, figuring stuff out because you're becoming an adult. Like, it's just normal stuff.
Well, and it's, I remember my parents, even to this day, will say that I had a rebellion when I was 14. And what it was, I mean, we kind of laugh at it now, but at the time I started hanging out with non-churched people. That was it.
And that was the rebellion.
Yeah. And I went over, I remember I had a crush on this guy who was microwaving weed and like drying it out and making joints. And you know, this like straight out of like an after school special. I was like, oh my goodness, drugs, those are drugs. But it's so funny because what my parents didn't know, and which is that in my rebellion, quote unquote, I was actually trying to save him. Like I was like preaching the gospel right. to these kids. He was my mission because, well, I had a crush on him too. So I thought, well, the only way I can right. date him is if he gets saved. Confusing. But even in my rebellion, I was still like doing the Lord's work. Mm-hmm. So it's just fascinating because it's like, that's not really a rebellion. That was just me being a good foot soldier.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. It didn't work, by the way. He wasn't yeah. interested. No.
Well, we could have seen that coming.
Yeah.
What is your relationship like with your parents? You said you talked to them about deconstruction. Are they obviously, I mean, they must know that you are where you're at to some yeah. extent because it's very public, but, what is that like? Have your parents deconstructed in some ways? Are they just open to talking about stuff?
Mm. Yeah. I feel like the way that I'm able to talk with my family, more so my dad, I think that my mom still feels like when I question things, it feels shaky for her. I don't think she loves that feeling. Whereas my dad, mm-hmm. because he's like PhD, like academic, he kind of enjoys the shake. And he has the answers for it because he spends all day studying, whereas my mom is not doing that. So I think she's less inclined to have those conversations and sometimes thinks that when we're having them, that maybe we're like fighting, but like in a very Canadian way. We're never really fighting. We're just like expressing different beliefs. But I'd say that we're able to do it in a really respectful way, which I'm really grateful for because I think it's extremely rare. It gives me hope that I can have those kinds of conversations with at least one person because it makes me mm-hmm. think like, if I can do it with one person, then there must be more than one I can do that with, where he has his beliefs, I have mine. We're able to kind of like see in the middle. And I would say it's a lot more of him trying to understand me because I kind of already know his stance on most things. But we will at Christmas, we have a very strange family that way. It's not uncommon for us to like, for 4 to 5 hours a day when I'm home, talk about stuff. Whether wow. it's, oh yeah, we get right into it. Like we'll go for coffee or my brother is a pastor too. So sometimes oh. my dad and I and him will get together and talk, but usually it's always started with me kind of like slowly, like soft lobbing some ideas and usually more appealing to the humanity of an issue than like, I never come in hot because I find that doesn't really work very much. So yeah. It might be more like, I remember when Canada banned conversion therapy, we had a long mm-hmm. talk about that. I did feel myself get a little hot under the collar on that one because that's it fair. Hits so close to home, mm-hmm. but I was able to tell them why, which I feel like they understood. That being said, my dad, I don't know entirely where he shifted, but I do feel like he shifted in the sense of like hell. I think we've had a lot of conversations around that where he's shifted a bit about what that is or what that might look like. The second coming, like rapture. I really feel like he has a completely different understanding of that. Like it's not like shoes are in the ground and people are in the air. He's really mm-hmm. taken that and moved that. And then most recently, when it comes to LGBTQ stuff, the Clobber passages, let's say, I know for sure that he has changed his mind about the Genesis, like Sodom and Gomorrah passage, does not think that's about homosexuality anymore.
Wow.
The other ones are, that one is like the easiest one to kind of shake out of people. So, but it's hopeful to know that if there's that one, there'll be others. In fact, my dad teaches a Bible study in our queer nonprofit. So, and he's been doing it for 3 years, and it's an interesting scenario because they all know where he's at. So everyone kind of signed in knowing that everyone's in a, maybe a different place, but they love each other. And I think that's really changed. Like he loves these people, you know, a couple of them are married. There's a couple in our nonprofit that just adopted children. Things that in the past would have been immediate, like that is wrong. That's, oh my goodness, what is the world coming to? Are now right. He's calling and saying, did you hear the adoption went through? That's so exciting.
Wow.
Or there's another person who's on their way of like becoming a deacon in the Episcopalian church. And he's trying to use my dad's Bible study as like credit towards becoming a deacon. And so my dad will call and say, oh, did you hear, you know, I think they're going to let us use the Bible study so that he can like continue in his like leadership in the church. And, you know, these people are all gay. This is a place where he would never have been okay with it. So in that sense, it's exciting to see movement, and I understand it takes time. So I try to hold space, he tries, and we all sort of exist in that world, but they've showed up for me in a pretty big way. Which is like super not common. So I feel mm-hmm. really lucky because I hear so many stories of how parents do not show up in ways that are actually terrorizing and inhumane. So mm-hmm. I'm very lucky that my family tries to at least be on the journey with me and with my partner as well. That was a big moment, you know, bringing a woman into the family as my partner. I mean, that's when the rubber hits the road, and that's when you yeah. see what people are made of. And that's when you see whether they're going to show unconditional love or not. And so not a lot of white small town evangelical people have to come up against this. So when they do, I think mm-hmm. that's when you really see their true faith in action.
Yeah. I think that's huge. For all the work that he's done, especially in your nonprofit and just being so open to that, you definitely played a huge role, I think, in all of that for him. Like, I feel like he's doing it for you and feel like, and through that, he's challenging his own sort of thinking around that. And for him to start to be like having an open mind without just, you know, going from one side to the other, I think is really awesome. And it shows that he loves you. And
oh, for sure. I mean, that is the ultimate love. I agree. I know he did it for me to start. I think that it's become something apart from me now. And now there's this group of people that he loves. But I have noticed, you know, I've gone into his study and sometimes I'll see books on queerness and the Bible, and I'll open them up and they're underlined and highlighted. And like, wow. I know he's doing the work, which mm-hmm. is like all you can really
understand.
Yeah, that's all you can really ask for. And I understand there's frustrations, like you want people to be somewhere quicker. But I don't know, because when I think of how long it took me to change and to believe and to know myself, it's like, if it happens overnight, that may not even be a genuine, like you said, if it happens too quickly, is that even real?
Yeah. It's almost like, I think if it happens too quickly, you didn't do the work to get there. It's like a knee-jerk reaction. It's kind of like when you deconstruct and you just all of a sudden become a full-blown atheist and think nothing is real and you're angry and you're just sort of becoming a hater on the other side. Then I feel like you didn't really do the work to challenge what you believe and really kind of sift through your values and be like, do I believe this? Do I not? And I think that whole thing takes time and it's going to change a lot along the way. So I think that's beautiful when parents really try to challenge themselves and try to like understand and educate themselves instead of just immediately rejecting that. I think that's like such a beautiful form of love. So I'm really happy for you that
thank you.
Your parents are doing that for you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm really grateful. I feel shocked at how I have to assume that for a lot of Christian families that don't do the work, it's because for them, it's their theology is sort of based on what comes from a pulpit from one person. Like they don't realize that there's like an academic discourse above all that, that siphons the information down. And that must be that in that space, they think that it is super black and white. I think I'm lucky that I have a father that knows from studying that nothing is ever black and white. But I have to assume that that's why people don't do the work, because I just can't imagine in a world in which I had a child who was having this. And I knew there was such a thing as queer theology. Like, I know it exists, but to not even crack a book.
Yeah.
Because you're like, I know for sure it's wrong. When really it's like, Max Lucado is affirming now. Like, there's a lot of like big theologians that we grew up with that are changing their mind around this. Like, why are you digging your heels in? It's so weird to me. No one's saying you have to change your mind. Just try.
Right. I think for some people, the unknown is so terrifying and debilitating that they don't even want to give it a chance. I really do think some people are not equipped. I don't know if it's mentally or what. I mean, I think we're all capable, but I really think some people are just so stuck in the comfort of having all the answers.
Yeah.
That when you challenge it in some way that their answers could be wrong, I think it kind of like gives them a midlife crisis to some extent. And they're like, I don't want to do that. Like it's too existential.
If you pull the thread, the whole thing's going to unravel.
Yeah. And oftentimes it does, but it's like, that's what growth is. And so, yeah, I know some people like that. My mom is kind of like that. I will say she's done some subtle changes, but in general, she's very much like, you know, rejects it immediately because it's like her brain can't handle the unknown or that something could be different than what she's always believed. I think it's too scary for her, which I can empathize with. It is scary.
Totally.
So I try to have grace for people, but I don't have grace for like hate and, you know, an inability to even like try to understand where someone else is coming from. Like that just is frustrating to me because humans are so complex and we all come from different places and it feels only natural that you would try to understand that. But I think when it comes to this mindset, they can't.
I totally agree with you. I think it is a stability thing. But again, that makes me think, well, it kind of swings back to the beginning of our conversation where it's like, if something can't take a little friendly fire, like then what is it? Yeah. What is it?
Your like foundation is
a little shaky.
It's on sand. Built on sand.
It's built on sand.
Build your home somewhere else.
Build it. Well, it's funny. A song I just released, I used that biblical, analogy because I talked about building it on the rock. Like I remember that growing up so much, this idea of, and all the songs we'd sing around building things on rock. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because the concept is actually this idea that you build everything in God, like it being the rock, but it can absolutely be also said that your faith needs to be built on a foundation that has enough strength to be able to withstand some tough questions. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you should use that analogy in more ways than just it being about God. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little too simple. And then you're like, actually.
Yeah. Right.
So I would like to get more into the nonprofit if you don't mind for a little bit. If you could tell us a little bit more about the Bad Believer community, and like how it's played a role in helping LGBTQ+ individuals like heal from religious trauma, how that all works. And obviously your dad's playing a part in it. So
like a little bit. It's a crazy, crazy story. Because it was one of those things that just sort of happened, serendipitously. So I, like most people that were trying to figure out who I was doing a lot of Google searching, to try to find answers. But one thing, like you said at the beginning, it's funny, there's so many reference back to the beginning of the interview, but community was just a heartbreaking loss for me. I felt very lonely. I felt like I couldn't talk to any Christian friends or family about what I was going through. And I couldn't really talk to many of my queer friends because, you know, shocking, but a lot of queer people don't love talking about religion. You know,
I wonder why.
I know. So sometimes I would find myself in this weird situation where I'd try to talk about it and I could tell that I had triggered like a lot of anger in one of my queer friends. And then I felt this funny need to defend it. So I was like very in the middle. And I basically was planning on coming out. I had written a song about my sort of falling in love with a woman for the first time. And when I came up to my family, I let them know that I wanted to share a little bit about that journey of feeling in the middle and feeling lonely. But I didn't want to do like a press release or anything because that seemed wasn't going to do that. So I just put a little bit of my story in the description of my YouTube video for the music video for the song. I just figured no one would probably really read it because not a lot of people read descriptions of YouTube videos fully. So it felt like a nice safe place to put it. So I put it in there and it sat there for a while without a lot of engagement. But then I had the song ended up being licensed in this really beautiful LGBTQ love scene that has this really amazing, vibrant community that follows the show. And a lot of them are LGBTQ plus. And so what happened was they all started flooding my YouTube page and they found my write-up of growing up in the church and feeling alone and all this. So then I kind of woke up the next day to like thousands of emails in my inbox of people saying, you know, this is me, I'm alone. I'm hidden in my car writing this to you. I don't know what to do. I feel lonely. People in countries where obviously it's like a crime to be gay and just this outcry of sadness. And I don't know if it's because of growing up in a ministry world, but I just felt this instinct that I had to do something. I have said that I feel like almost anyone would want to do that. Some people are like, no, I don't think everyone would, but I think just coming from my world, I thought, okay, I have to do something. So I made a sign up form for people to have Google calls, to have a Zoom calls to talk about it. And it grew like crazy. And so within a couple months, we had hundreds of people that were coming in and they were all having this call and then looking at me thinking like, okay, well now what? Like now we've opened up and we've shared and we feel seen and connected. So we worked really quickly to assemble this organization and built some systems in place. And one of the first things that I did, this is also like a moment of growth for me coming from the church, is there's like, I'm sure you've talked about this in many podcasts, but there's this bad habit of people feeling like they are qualified to do things that they are not qualified to do. Mm-hmm. So I am not a therapist. I have no training. I might have some like intuitive gifts. I might have an ability to communicate, but I am like not a therapist. So the first thing that I did was like, find someone. Luckily, it was someone who actually came in through a call, who is now our director of community mental health, who, you know, has an actual degree in this world. So we just tried to set up systems and we started doing therapy referral programs to really emphasize the fact that we are here to support, we're here to mm-hmm. listen, but we're also here to pass you to the qualified people to kind of make this happen for you, because we were seeing ranges of people coming in from like, and it's funny because the word trauma obviously was weird for folks too, because some people were like, I don't know if I have trauma, right. but I have these feelings. Whereas, and mm-hmm. then there are people who are coming in with full blown conversion therapy experiences, right? Or right. abuse, assault. So obviously there was such a range that for us, we were like aggregating and connecting and finding ways to express what we're feeling, but we have to find outlets for people to have more support than that. So that was a big point of it. And then it just grew. So it's a online community. We provide resources, therapy referrals, and mostly community support for anyone who is from that space, who has a religious background, who is LGBTQ plus. We are not a faith community, but we're also like, we're a faith community and a non-faith community. Like there's no, one of the first things I say when people come in is like, this is not like a sneaky evangelical group where we're going to make you feel super comfy. And then like for us, it is about spirituality because our motto is your spiritual life is your birthright. But that's kind of it. It's about at least getting people who are queer to see that their spiritual life is inherently theirs, that no one can take it from you. And it's wild because people who aren't from church systems think, well, of course a gay person can have a spiritual life. But plenty of people come in feeling like God has been taken from them, that they're an abomination, that they can't connect. So our main goal is to empower people to explore. Sometimes that brings people back to their faith. And for those people, you know, my dad does the Bible study, things like that. But for a lot of people, they are, you know, pagan, atheists, they're agnostic. And so for that, it's more of just like, okay, how can we support those journeys? What do you believe? What is it like? And it is like deconstructing a lot of the narratives and allowing people to kind of rewrite those tapes that, you know, the number one thing that people feel coming in is a fear of hell across the board. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's it. There are similarities and there are differences, but that one tends to be the most pervasive. And I tell a story of how we had someone in our community who was actually a minister, a woman minister, who had done a ton of work at reconciling queerness and her faith. But one day she got in a car accident, and it was like a really scary one where she felt like she had that like life flashing before her eyes. Mm-hmm. And the thought that went through her head is, please don't send me to hell.
Yeah.
So it is still there, right? Like even after all that. So it's a lot of like letting people know to not beat themselves up when those intrusive thoughts come back. But, you know, people, even people who aren't gay have that, whether you're from that system, and to allow yourself to know that these are things that we will work through until we're no longer here. It's just a reality of the situation. It's not a quick fix.
Yeah. And I think too, especially, with being gay, it's like a straight ticket to hell, like from the evangelical community. And I think that's probably why they're struggling with it so hard. I mean, that was the number one thing that I struggled with too. But I wasn't like, there's just no like quick, I mean, I guess leaving the faith too is also like technically a straight ticket to hell, but I feel like being gay is just, it's like pounded into you that like, there's no hope for you if you're queer, you know?
Well, it's sort wild. Of like, and it's wild because these are people who actually genuinely still have their faith system. So like by all, in all accounts, they are quote unquote good Christian people.
And saved.
They just, they're saved. They just have this piece of them that, you know, and some of them are, you know, we have side A and side B Christians. I don't know if you know much about that terminology, but it's like side A Christians, queer Christians and side B. So there's like a group of people who believe that there's nothing wrong with having a partner and being married and having children. And then the people who feel that their response to their sexuality is to be celibate.
Which
we try to support both of those. It's a tricky thing. Like it's a lot of me trying to like not have an opinion. But there have been times where people have, where their beliefs have seemingly been torturing them. And that's when I think we do try to not intervene, but maybe just be like, maybe let's challenge that. Like, because it's a lot of, well, this is my cross to bear. You know, a lot of that language, very, but it is like a very unique cross to bear. And it is one of the biggest things I say to, you know, conservative folks or even people who come in who are still conservative is like, this is a very unique sin, quote unquote, in the sense that it does not act like any other. And yet we don't acknowledge that. It's like, it's put in the same list as all these other things when it's actually doesn't have a signature of sin like other things might. And I say this, of course, with quoting around sin every time, just so people know, you know, there's ways out of sin in other circumstances. There's ways that you can be healed from addiction. You know, if you have like a fractured marriage, there are steps forward. also when you're in a space of living in sin, let's say, like things that are actually destructive to your spirit, you feel it, like you can feel that something is wrong. There's a darkness. I don't think the concept of sin is necessarily all evil. I think that to say that there are things that are beneficial for us and not beneficial for us, maybe that's a better way of saying it. If you're doing something that's not beneficial, you know it. But with this quote unquote sin, we see people thriving, people happy, people falling in love, having families. So to me, it's like, if it's not acting the same, then we have to look at that because then maybe something is wrong. So it's a lot of people coming in saying, I have a cross to bear, but I'm also like, right, but it's causing you to be depressed. It's causing you to have thoughts that are very dark, which does not seem very fruits of the spirit to me. So it is an interesting world of different kinds of people all coming together.
Yeah. Sounds like it. That's interesting. But I love that you are just holding a space for everyone, no matter where they're at on their journey. Cause I think that is really important to do instead of being like, no, you have to fit this bill or you have to fit this bill, because then that's almost like putting us back into the same environment as the church. We're like,
exactly.
Versus exactly. Just being like, let's all just coexist together and we won't judge each other and we'll just accept each other where we're at on our journeys.
Yeah.
I think that is
the answer.
Like, essence of community.
But it is way harder. Like, that is the thing. If there's anything I've learned from this, there is nothing harder than holding space for this many people with this many beliefs and not feel like you want to assert some kind of control just to feel like you can navigate. I understand where that comes from, because the reality is when you're dealing with lots of different things, it takes a ton of energy to hold that space for everybody. So I could see why people feel inclined to create rules and structures, because then it's like more manageable, but that is where all the problems lie, right? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because then it kind of just snowballs from there.
Exactly.
Well, that is awesome. I think that's so important in any way. If you can just have some sort of community for people to go that are dealing with these things, because there's really like nothing else out there. And it's hard to just find people in your everyday life that understand what you're going through and understand where you're at, because we all come from different like areas of it. And I don't know. It's important. It's important. So I want to do like a little bit of a gear change and, kind of go back into like go to your music now, as far as like, your inspiration, kind of behind True Love Waits.
Yeah.
And sort of like your emotional journey and your songwriting, which I know those were broad, but like, True Love Waits. I guess my listeners knows I will never stop talking about purity culture, because it's purity culture and there's so many things to say about it forever and always. But this song draws from your experiences within the purity culture movement. So I guess with that obviously impacted you. And so I guess I'm wondering why you chose to explore that in your music, and if you can just share more about the inspiration behind this song.
Yeah. I mean, purity culture is, I was actually doing an interview not that long ago with someone who said I think they've interviewed over 250 people from this world, and every single one of them had something to say about purity culture. Yep. Yes. It's like pervasive. And it's wild, because it is, again, another complicated thing, because for some people, purity culture narratives really worked for them. I think of my parents, for example. They waited until they were married. They have a really beautiful marriage. So it's almost like they won the jackpot of like this narrative really working for them. But I think with anything in life where you have something like a rule that, where there are more stories that are from the opposite side of things, that doesn't necessarily mean that something's working. It just means that people are lying. And I'm sure you've talked about this a lot. on your podcast, just the aspect of the hidden nature, the secrecy. The song actually came from, I wanted to write about purity culture because we do talk about it in the nonprofit, because obviously clearly with queerness, it's to go back to what you said before, it's a double whammy again of like, especially when you come from the world of if you think it, you've done it. Because then for queer people, they're like feeling bad, not only for thinking about it, but also the fact that it's same sex, which was big no-no. So that was extremely hard and causes a lot of people, at least we've seen in our community, a lot of people to really shut down sexually. A lot of dissonance, a lot of detachment from their bodies, a lot of like identifying as asexual, because they just, you know, when you can't do something, you psychologically will siphon it off. So there's a lot of people who come in who, part of actually what we do in the community, we have a room in Discord where we like allow people to flirt and to try to reconnect with their sensual side. That was like a big thing because a lot of people were like, I'm the only person I know that's this old that's a virgin. I'm the only person I know that this old that is this old that's never been kissed. So it is like practicing these feelings that most people have when they're 12 and 13, but people are 60. So it is like a big range.
They can
so
never do anything with them.
Yeah, they can't. So now they're like stumbling into this like adolescence, which is terrifying, but also kind of fun. I think it is nice that they're at least being able to have that experience in their lifetime. Yeah. But there's a lot of like feeling sad about the loss of time, obviously.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to write about purity culture because I was doing this record based on religious themes, queerness, and reconciling all of that. So I felt like I needed to touch on purity culture. But my song specifically, because I did date boys and men growing up. So it wasn't necessarily about a queer experience, although I do think people who are queer can identify with the song as well. It was sort of like this unspoken thing where you take this really beautiful, like innocent and sweet connection, and you put all of these really hard expectations on, and how, because I was so committed to God and so committed to my faith, I dated a lot of boys that were the same. And so we had these like very serious feelings around how we connected that were like, in some ways, even more adult than the things that conservatives are saying are scary. Like it's like, is sex an important decision? Yes. Should people feel safe? Yes. Is consent important? Yes. Should we like encourage everyone to run around and sleep with everyone at a young age? I'm not saying that, but I am saying that similarly, you know, when they're like, we don't want kids to grow up too fast. Like we were having the most grown up feelings. Yeah.
They failed in that area.
Totally. This grooming thing, this grooming argument, it's like bonkers because there were things I was contemplating, my eternal, like my damnation, my salvation, all intertwined with like a natural urge because I was always very sensual. I was always sensual and I was curvy. I developed early. So there was like a lot of this downplaying who I was, trying to be smaller. And then in my intimate relationships, we were constantly like passing the buck of, oh, we went too far. Okay, it's your fault this time. Or like you try now. Cause I tried last time. Okay. And then when you mess up, it's like at some point your partner at that young age becomes you build resentment because they are actually actively causing you to distance from God.
Yeah.
And I don't know any young relationship that can handle that. So my relationships would always fall apart because we had no healthy way to connect. And we were teenagers and we had millions of hormones. And I just felt exhausted by the journey. So it was easier to walk away. It was easier to kind of throw in the towel than to stay in these partnerships where I knew the only way out was to get married, which felt like really premature for me. Thankfully, because I know for a lot of people, like they just end up getting married, but No, which and no one talked about it.
Which is also such a huge grown-up thing to put on 15 and 16-year-olds. I'm like,
100%.
So you're going to decide your partner for like the next 50 years when you're 15 based on the fact that you don't want me to have sex, which is a very natural, normal thing to feel at 16?
Yes.
It's just, and I knew friends that did that, and half the marriages did not work out, or they just got married and had babies right away and didn't pursue anything, you know, even remotely personal to them. Like, it was just sort of like, it became all about sex. And then it was like, well, you have to get married first, which changes your life completely.
100%. Well, and there's plenty of evangelicals that think that your partnership and marriage actually extend into the afterlife.
Really?
That you're married. Yeah. That you're married forever. Because it's
I guess I heard that theory. I guess I did hear that.
Yeah, because when we die, we're the same. Like we see our family, right? We see the same people. So
and you'll
of course,
see your spouse
like
in the afterlife, which is like too much. It's too much. Oh, and now I have to see you here too.
Forever.
Because I made a choice when I was 20.
No. Yeah. So in that sense, it's wild because, and I mean, I don't know how much experience you feel with that too, but I think that part of that pressure is partly why, thankfully, in retrospect, I didn't get married. I think I always knew that it was a decision for eternity. So it was like a big, even dating was terrifying. Like I remember like none of the guys when I was in college, I just remember guys like not dating anyone. Like we were all just so scared of making the wrong choice. And then of course, like there's that extra pressure of like no one really knowing where the line is because it's such an arbitrary line depending on what pastor you speak to. Like some pastors are like, oh yeah, you can like fool around a little bit. You want to get
kiss.
A sense.
You can hold hands. Yeah.
Yeah. But it ranges from, oh, well, you should feel around a bit to you should like not kiss until you're married. So there's,
you shouldn't be alone together.
You shouldn't be alone. So there is such a massive range. And then of course, for me, I went to Bible college and it's just like, it was very clear to me. I'm not trying to throw away something that might work for people, but it was very clear to me in Bible college that like everyone was super sexually repressed and frustrated. So it was coming out in really weird ways. And that's what happens. It comes out in such weird ways because it will come out somehow. So a lot of people with like, you know, in college, it was just like people were sneaking around, in cars and small spaces because we couldn't even step. I remember in my college, like we couldn't even step on the boys' side of the, like even outside of their dorm. Like there was a gravel thing that went around the outside of the dorm. And if you stepped onto the gravel, like someone would say something to you. So it was, so it's one of those things where it's like, to give some credit, I guess, to people, no one was really telling the truth. So I guess for a really long time, everyone just thought it was working. But I've had enough conversations. I had enough conversations when I was young and enough conversations as an adult to know that most people were either becoming asexual, like cutting themselves completely off, riddled with guilt and shame because of their like thought life. Was that the word they used to call it? Like the health of your mind and, you know, pornography, obviously a huge one, people developing really like intense relationships with pornography, in the secrecy of the night, as opposed to like,
which is
just
interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, as opposed to just acknowledging that these are like natural things and coming up with nuanced language to kind of talk about it. So instead we take this thing that's natural and it becomes something like really dark and like honestly perverted, like seriously perverted in the way that we look at it.
Yes. Yeah. That is, yeah, that's something that I still want to explore more on this podcast a little bit, but, just the thing with the opposite sex, like even just not being alone with them, like avoiding them, not being able to step on the freaking gravel outside their dorm, like things like that are so bad for you because they almost like turn men or, you know, boys into this sort of one. I think it almost makes them unsafe. Yeah. But it also doesn't teach you how to interact with them. Like, I feel like I stumbled in my 20s interacting with guys because all I was taught was they wanted something more from me. Like, it was like, and if you had friends and you guys got too close, you know, then it was like, you were scrutinized for it. And so then there's that aspect, but then there's also like the sexual aspect where people like are developing porn addictions, but they think it's because of porn. And in reality, they're so incredibly suppressed and they're afraid to just jerk off when they want to, that they do this weird thing with like, oh, it's in secret and all of this stuff. And I knew a guy who and his wife, where he thought he had an addiction because they waited, you know, to have anything before marriage. And then it just sort of spiraled. And I think he developed an unhealthy relationship with it, which I think you can with anything.
Totally.
But I literally commented because then he made it public and then he wanted to have porn support groups for people. And he wanted, you know, him and his wife to help you work through it.
Right.
And how it almost ended his marriage. It became this huge thing. And I literally commented on his status after like the second time he posted about it. And I was like, I feel like a lot of this is like because you are suppressed by purity culture and not an actual porn addiction. And of course, he never replied to that. But I was literally like, dude, this is screaming purity culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's literally all it is because you were felt so ashamed to do a very normal human thing and masturbate.
Yep.
That's.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying porn addictions aren't real, and I'm not trying to say that, but I'm saying at least in this context, there's so much of it that just purity culture, it just makes you take normal biological things and turn them into something that you have immense shame over, and it affects you the rest of your life. I mean, if you're trying to have relationships with people later on, if you're trying to have sex later on, if you're trying to explore your body and see what you like later on, like it affects all of that. And it doesn't seem fair.
Agree.
We had to be raised in that and then try to like get over it in our adulthood and figure out, you know.
Yeah, that idea that like 1 second, you know, there's also this weird, bizarre thing that you should be able to make this gymnastics Olympic size flip from being no, pure, to all of a sudden being like, and now we're like super sexual because we're married. And I'm like, on you all the time. And we're, you know, it's like, what? Like, how are people supposed to do that? And one thing that I noticed, this is like really, they don't. Because they have weird feelings around sex. The one thing that I've noticed, which I don't know if you've gotten into much on the podcast, but I find really fascinating is I think that there's like a certain kink that develops of this saying no, this like, no, we can't. That's like so sexy in this like kind of like, oh, we shouldn't. Oh no. Because it's centered in desire. There's this like, I want you so bad, but I can't have
like edging.
It is. It is 100% that, to the point where when all of a sudden you're allowed, I think it can feel very deflating for people and they feel like something is missing. It's like, oh, the thing that's missing is that like desire to be bad or to like, oh, like, well, God forgive us. And it's wild because you like simultaneously really don't want to make God angry. But then also like there's something that's fused in it that
you're
feels very,
it.
That feels very sexy. Yeah. So
100%. That's interesting. I actually haven't thought about that before, but that makes a lot of sense.
Because then when you're just like normal, having normal, like married, like book
consensual
sex, like like you read your book and then you like shut it and you're like, okay, like it's like something doesn't feel as exciting.
Right. Ah, we're so screwed. No, I'm just kidding. Thanks a lot, purity culture. Yeah, I'm sure tons of people go listen to True Love Waits because I also looked up the lyrics because I was like, because, you know, you listen to a song, you don't catch all the lyrics at first. And I was like, oh, yeah, this makes sense. Been there.
Did it hit home?
Yes.
Yes.
I was like,
good. I wanted it to. It's one of those funny things where when I was in the studio making the record, I was talking to my producer who does not come from this world at all. And I'm like, okay, so the concept is I want to make like a pop record, but talking about you know, purity culture, coming out to religious family, the church trying to save like, you. He's like, what? And I really did want it to sound, I could have made like a ballad album or like a really dark, moody record. There are some songs like that, obviously, on the album, but I did want to take, I think it's incredible. Music is such a great way to be able to like broach some of these things. And style, I think, is really important. So I wanted to choose styles that would allow for people to like get into the lyrics, but to not be like overly, what's the right word? To not be like overly influenced by the tone of it. So like True Love Waits, it could be a totally different lyrical song and you'd be like, it just sounds like a driving pop song.
Right.
But I don't see a lot of, I don't know, but maybe you do. Maybe you can tell me. I haven't really heard a lot of songs that talk about purity culture. And it's such a universal, for a lot of people, like a universal experience. Because, you know, purity culture is not even just limited to religious families. Like, it's very pervasive in our society. So I wanted to kind of show a little bit of the underbelly. I think more, not so much to kind of like do like gotcha or like a pointed finger, but more just for people to feel seen. Because I think for a lot of us, we carry a lot of that feeling like we failed, like we weren't strong enough, and we see these propped up examples of people that did it right. And you're just like, oh, that wasn't me. And like something's wrong with me. Why wasn't I able to do that? And I just think it's like, that is a super destructive thing for people to feel on a regular basis.
It is. Yeah. And especially as someone who didn't do it, didn't work for me. It's such a complicated, purity culture is complicated, but then like you see people who successfully did it and you're like, well, why couldn't I do it? And yeah, I agree.
And who knows really what was going on there.
Right.
The more you dig into people's past. Who knows
if they really did it. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So you've released a few EPs, or not EPs, but you've released a few songs from your EP Hymnal.
Yeah.
Right? Already. But the full one is supposed to be released on March 22nd.
Yes. It comes out March 22nd.
So... You kind of talked a little bit about the themes of the EP, but are there any like more like specific messages or emotions you like hope listeners take away from the EP, I guess?
Yeah.
Like you're hoping people
feel
and like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. The first song, Brave, is like the feelings and questions that circle around your head when you're trying to come out to religious family communities. And that song is inspired by my own journey because I had a lot of those questions, but it was also inspired by the Bad Believer community because we have a lot of people come in who are out. And it's funny, like most of our conversations are just people asking a ton of questions. Like, are they going to love me the same? Will they still like want to touch me and see me as their daughter or their son? Or their child. And so it was really just wanting for people to feel seen in that really terrifying and vulnerable spot before you come out. And then the other songs, you know, they kind of jump around, but I do have two that aren't out yet that are coming out on the full album. One of them is called If There Is a God. And it's sort of like probably the most pointed of the songs. And it really is about what we've already discussed today. This idea that like, if there is a God and he sent his son, the lyric is, if there is a God and he sent his son, he'd turn our tables one by one. So it's very much like a chastising of like this, what we're claiming to be faith is not looking at all like what the Christianity that comes from the Gospels is. And just sort of a reminder for people that are from those spaces that are queer, that they're being like removed in a painful way. So that one's more pointed. And then there's another one called If Something Is Good, which again is maybe more of a reach across the aisles. And it's sort of asking the question, if something is good, like if your faith is good, if God is good, is that faith system or is God going to actually ask you to choose between it and the people you love? Like that doesn't seem overly good. That's not good news to me. So just really exploring those ideas. And then, of course, the last song on the record is a love song to my mom and dad, as like a thank you for showing up and for being there for me. And it's hard because when I sing that, I've sung that song live a couple times in front of LGBTQ plus audiences. And it like simultaneously is like a hopeful song, but it's also really painful because I think there's a lot of people who hear it and think like, that wasn't my experience.
Mixed emotions.
So, yeah. It's wild because I think there's something really important about providing, telling stories of when it does work out and encouraging parents to listen to that song and realize that like your child could feel the way I did. And that's how they'll, I remember when I came out and my dad, the first thing he said to me, it was like, it was burned in my brain. I'll never forget it. Like that will be my story until the day I die. And I think people need to realize that when people are telling you something that is so vulnerable that it's like the core of who they are, that they, that moment when they say it, it will forever be burned into them. So not necessarily that you have to accept, but you have to be mindful that that is something they'll never forget.
Yeah. And like, that goes with like, it's not even necessarily exactly what they said, but it's how they made you feel.
Totally.
Like it's like a simultaneously, like even if you like are 40 years from now and you forget exactly what they said, like you're going to remember exactly how they made you feel.
Totally.
And I think if anyone tells you anything important in that way, your first response, no matter if you're there, your parent or anything, you know, you need to, like, I feel like your first response should be some form of compassion, even if you, you know, are shocked or, you know, don't feel a certain way. Like, I think that's so important. And I think, I don't know if that's like an unhealed thing in parents as to why they don't do that, but I feel like a common response is like generally 50-50. And I'm like saddened by that because these are big conversations and you're looking to your parent for acceptance when you tell them.
You're so right, because it could be as simple as just holding your child and not saying
just
anything.
Just giving them a hug. It's the same when like someone tells you somebody died.
Yes.
You know, just to some extent, it's what you say next, how you react, how you hold space for them is huge. And you don't have to say anything. They're not actually looking for your opinion.
Yeah.
They're just looking for you to be like, okay, that's okay. Like, it's okay. That's like all you want to hear.
Yeah, it is wild. It is like a tricky human mind thing where I think some parents immediately go to it being about them or like how they failed or how did I not see this?
It's a personal thing that they take upon themselves for sure. It's like
it goes to self immediately when it's like, oh. And you know, it's funny because that song, the song is called What Love Is All About. And it really doesn't have to be about someone's queer journey. It could be I don't know your story really much at all, but like there may have been a moment where you had to talk to a parent about how you have different beliefs and know that you're going to like disappoint them, maybe break their heart. Anyone who's had to like kind of come clean or be vulnerable and honest about who they are, knowing that the reaction might be extremely disappointing and maybe really heartbreaking. That is always difficult. So, you know, when you can tell someone is distraught, like, I don't know, I was completely drained. The blood drained from my body the moment I said it out loud. It's like, just hold them for just a minute. And then you can work through the cycling thoughts that are going through your brain. That's normal, but just hold them just for, because they're never going to forget that moment of how they felt. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's great advice, y'all. Just
parents,
give someone a hug.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up and give someone a hug.
If anyone needs to take anything from this episode, it's that. You're right, because it's not just parents, it's friends. I mean, sometimes we can't confide in parents, so we have to confide in our friends, right? So there's lots of opportunities.
And you come out to your friends, too, and they also have shitty reactions. And just shut up.
Yeah.
Reach for a hug.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I know we didn't, like, hit every single topic, but I really enjoyed talking to you. And I am wondering if you can like tell our listeners like how to find you and your music, and if you have any, we have listeners from all over, so I don't know if you have any upcoming like live music dates that you'd want to share.
Thank you. Well, thank you. This has been such a great chat. It's like the time has just flown by. Meeting people. You know, I've often said to people that when you meet people from a similar background, it's like there's just this beautiful unspoken like language and understanding between you, that really like the outside world doesn't always really get or understand. So it's always really beautiful to connect with people who instantly kind of get you.
So, online, I am
I'm very lucky where all my handles are the same. So on every platform, it's just Adaline Music. So A-D-A-L-I-N-E Music. And then tour dates. I do have some tour dates coming up, and I'll be announcing more soon. So all my tour dates will be at adalinemusic.com on my website. And as far as like listening to the music, it's, you know, streaming wherever people stream music. So pretty easy to find on any streaming platform, just under my stage name. So
awesome. Perfect. Well, thank you so much. And everyone go check out Adaline's music, because it's fire. And it sounds like your new hymnal is going to resonate hard with people deconstructing. And I love that. I love in any form that we can sing about it or talk about it. It just makes us feel more seen and more, I don't know. It's like when it's like a sigh of relief sometimes when you hear someone else talk about the things that you're struggling with. And I love that you can do it musically. I'm excited.
Yeah, I love that too. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And we'll see you next time, guys. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Cheers to Leaving. Please consider leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe and share with your friends and others who are on a journey of deconstruction and are looking to expand their horizons.
If you're looking for a community that understands what it's like leaving religion and are going through the same process as you, consider joining our Facebook support group. Be a part of the conversation, meet like-minded individuals, and get support. You can find the link in our show notes. We love hearing from you, so drop us a message, share your thoughts, or suggest topics you'd like us to discuss in future episodes. Email us at cheerstoleaving@gmail.com. Take care and catch you on the next episode of Cheers to Leaving.